forward. No, no.
And I'll say, can you tell us about how the crews anticipated Cod War experiences?
Well, unless you'd actually been there, you didn't know what to expect. Going to sea is always going to be a difficult job. And then the degree of difficulty comes along with bad weather, freezing conditions, which you learn to cope with. But then on top of that, when you know you could lose your livelihood by a vessel chopping your one means of earning your living, the anger is very prevalent. And when it's a boat that's got armed guards on with guns and pea shooters on and things like that, and you are out there literally at their mercy, the worst thing was that you would have British warships, etc., stood by, very close by, but giving you no assistance whatsoever. It was all a bit of a show, if you like, and the only thing that the British ones ever did was prevent you having a little altercation with the Icelandic gunboats, which happened on several occasions, as you've probably seen in reports. And when we got near, sometimes the Icelandic boats would come along near you and maybe taunt you a little bit, but you'd be taunting them back.
What would they be doing?
They would fire in the air sometimes, literally with the Kalashnikovs or whatever they had. They would fire in the air and, like, you know, stand there as staunch, we are Navy Icelandic bravado, if you like. And we would be stood there with literally bags of flour, eggs, potatoes, things like that. And if they got pretty close, it's surprising how what distance you can cover with an egg. So that was the sort of things that we was giving them just as much back. However, we were not armed and we with what we had. You could laugh about it because you never took it really as serious as what it could have been. As you know, there was never deaths or anything like that. There were some close calls, but all that time, you've got fighting spirit. You have to have fighting spirit to be out at sea. You're not the normal type of guy on the street. You have to be there. You have to be courageous. You're against the elements. And you learn very soon that the elements is going to beat you. So what do? You learn to work along with the elements. Similarly with gunboats and things, you would maybe sacrifice one ship towards where the gunboat was. They would be the decoy, if you like, while several other ships could fish and get some fish on board. Just a little bit, not very good if you were the decoy, we know, but you knew where your position was.
Where did the planning for this take place?
Well, we were never allowed much because I was in them days on the deck, of course. Well, the skippers seemed to know what they were doing between them. They all sort of
Do you think they discussed this before they set sail?
I think it was, yeah. Before they ever got out there, they would discuss, you know, who would be in this position. The strangest thing is fishermen, by nature normally, don't like working too much with other fishermen. As your dad had maybe told you at one time, the last thing you wanted if you was catching a load of fish was your mates coming across the horizon and thinking, oh no, we won't have any fish in a minute because they'll catch it as well. So it was not a natural thing to have about all these ships working together in close proximity because of what was going on.
So planned ashore rather than over the airways?
Oh, definitely. Must have been.
In the Grimsby pubs and clubs?
Well, in the clubs, mainly. Skippers didn't do the pub scene very much because that was a cruise domain and left to be as it should be. They might come in and buy you a pint and say, all right, good trip, lads. And then they would disappear up to the higher places, the Waverley clubs in Cleethorpes and such, which were members only.
The GCHQ.
You've got it, yeah. And it was possibly the right thing to do. Because some of the things that they would have planned, they wouldn't want blabbed all over the place. because, as you know, a few drops of alcohol creates loose tongues, to say the least.
Tell us about some of the close shaves, then.
With me in particular, I only had a couple of close shaves with them. On one occasion, it was on the Northern Gift. I was deckhand on the Northern Gift, and the Aeger was, we were on the standby. We didn't have gear down. We were trying to protect our brothers, you know, and such. But the Aeger had been flaunting it and chopped one of the boat's warps and steaming along. And our skipper at the time was very annoyed about it. So he decided that we would attack the Icelandic gunboat. So he steamed full. He warned us, he said, we're going for this. He was angry. And we got pretty close to the Aeger when in between came a British tug called, I think it was the Englishman that did it first ever. They called the Englishman, this big tug came in between us to so fend us off and push the gunboat out. And he took the brunt of what would have been a collision, which could have finished up very nasty, but that was one occasion. And later on, I had a similar one in the Valises, I believe I was in, when we was on the guard, and the Beast brother, Colin Newton, he got fed up of it, and he says, oh, I'm going to, you know, have a go at him. Whether it was, he was just going to show, get out of it type thing. But a similar, and then that one was the Statesman, I believe, got in between, and pushed us away, just kept us away, like, you know.
The Statesman, is that another tug?
Yeah, these were big ocean-going tugs, based out of Hull, United Towing. So they were out there, but they were more to defend the Icelandics, I think, than what they were to stop what was going on to us, because they'd been ordered to do so, same as the British warships.
Did you witness a warp cutting?
Yes, yeah.
Can you talk us through what happens?
It's the strangest thing ever, and it never happened to us. It happened to the ship alongside of us. And all you could see is this gunboat steaming towards his stern and then steaming down his starboard side of the boat in question. It was one of the K-boats. And then he literally passed by his beam and then went hard starboard across his gear, towing this paraplane. And once the paraplane's gone over the warps and connected it, it's just a matter of ding. Because, you know, then paraplanes were invented to clear mines. In the First and Second World War, they would literally cut through the cables what mines. So a trawler warp wouldn't be a great difficulty to these great big
things.
The
paraplane is a blade.
It's three blades on a triangle, and you catch one of the warps or both of them on it, and if the front one doesn't get them, the two back ones will get them, that's for sure. And it's just a cutting device. Very efficient. Caused a lot of problems, and once you've lost your gear, you've lost your gear. And if you're lucky enough to go and drag for your gear, what they would call, by the time you got your gear back and get your warps back, and then you got to resplice your warps, you will have lost a day or 2 days fishing. And if you got it back, that was, because you were talking deep water fishing. So it wasn't a pleasant experience.
Were there serious injuries as a consequence of that?
I don't believe there was any really serious injuries, which is more luck than judgment.
But great risk.
Yeah. I mean, you hear the ones about the Everton and such, where they actually fired on the gunboats, but all they did was put holes through the funnel and such like that. But it doesn't matter, because somebody could have been stood around and, you know, so it was close calls. At the time, we didn't find it that scary because it was happening, and as I said, it was youngsters and was full of it, like, you know, Viking sort of people out there. But afterwards, looking at it, if it had gone wrong, it would have gone badly wrong. And it was all a political fiasco anyway. We all knew in the end what it was.
So the buccaneering spirit that used to be reported in the tabloids.
Well, it exists. It exists between all seafarers. The go to sea, fishermen especially, we are the modern day buccaneers. That it's something in you that you enjoy the thrill of being out there and catching the fish. You don't go boarding other ships or all like that nowadays, but you direct your attention to catching fish. And if you see a load of fish come up, wow, you know, but if there's no fish, well then you've got to go and look for some. But the pioneering sort of feeling is still there, where other people on the shore would run away from bad weather, monstrous waves. Most fishermen relish them, you know. You're out there and let's go through it. It's a thrill, I suppose.
Were there many arrests?
Not that I can think of, no. There was one incident which I can relate to, which was not an arrest, but the strangest thing happened. And at the time, I was not in a deep sea ship, but still registered. I was in one of the catboats, the Ross Leopard, and we had to go into the Faroe Islands. And while we was in the Faroe Islands and gone to bed of a night time, when we got up in the morning, all our nets and everything had been slashed, ripped to pieces. Called the police down, and the police said, oh, we'll investigate. And there was an Icelandic ship there, so they went to the Icelandic ship ready to arrest the Icelandics and that. And the Icelandics, they even came to us and said, we haven't done it. It was local protagonists in the Faroe Isles who didn't like, it wasn't the sentiment of all the people there, just a few troublemakers. I thought it might be great to go and slash all our nets things. That was one incident which was, you know, not very good.
The tabloids glorified Bunny Newton's great escape from Reykjavik. What was the perception of Grimsby fishermen at the time? Did they believe it?
Well, yeah, because he was seen as a Blackbeard type character escaping the British men of war. Things, you know, that's your perception of someone that's got real guts and things, that you would do what he did. Whether it went exactly as what the tabloids portrayed it, that's another thing.
What did you hear?
Well, we heard that they took him in and he was alongside, and while there were two inspectors on board and things had calmed down, he said throw off the ropes and made a dash for it, a run for it, which is very hard to believe in some ways that he would be left in that sort of situation. I mean, if it was a car, they would take a solenoid or something out of the engine, wouldn't they? Well, vessels are no different. You can take certain things out of the vessel and she won't be going anywhere. So I think it was a bit glorified, maybe.
Is Reykjavik an open harbour? There's no lockpit to get through then?
There wasn't. No, there isn't. No, it's an open harbour. Well, I haven't been for many, many years, but I've only been once in Reykjavik and once in Klaksvik. And they're open seaways, like, you know. They're so wide into their entrances, it wouldn't be feasible to put lock gates on things. All to the rise and fall.
That was the Brander, is that right?
That was the Brander, yeah.
Were there other escapes?
Chases. There was two or three other chases. The Brander and I think the Everton or one of them, Cock and Muscle, he had, when they fired on him, and that was a similar sort of thing, legal fishing. And I believe in the first Cod War, there was several incidents during the 50s whereby the vessels had gone on the run, but they caught up with them anyway, like, you know. Did what they have to do. I think the most thing they did was confiscate the gear and maybe confiscate the fish and then send them off with a hefty fine. But Bunny got a prison sentence, didn't he?
I don't remember.
Yeah, I'm sure it was Bunny that got a prison sentence. Or it might have been Cocker. Say, so it's a long, long time ago.
Sure. So when everything was settled, what was the view of Grimsby fishing?
What comes next? I remember having a conversation with Austin Mitchell over this same subject, and I went to see him at his surgery down the road here, and I sat there and he went, "Don't worry about anything, I'll get you compensation, I'll fight for you through Parliament and do this and that." I went, whoa, Austin, have I come here to ask you for compensation for losing the fishing grounds and that? He went, "Well, what have you come for?" He said, "I want someone who's going to fight for my future. All right, Iceland's gone, but there's other things and other places, retraining, restructuring, fish elsewhere, do all these things. That's what I'm interested in." I was only a young man at the time. And he couldn't answer me. That's how my mind works. Like, you know, if one door closes, what do? You find another one that's open and go and do it.
Could we have worked a deal with Iceland and continued some fishing?
The big yes. Harold Wilson refused a deal which was so good we couldn't even catch the amount of fish, which would lead us into, it wasn't a war about fish at all, because we were offered more than what we could catch. It was, as I always say, and I add to this day, it was a cold war between Russia and America, and Iceland was the most important place in that, because America had their bombers stationed at Iceland. Iceland did what they should do, which was protecting their fishing rights, and say, "Look, you can't all come in willy-nilly and catch all our fish," but they were prepared to give people quotas and things like that. However, the political dustbin, being what it is, had said, "No, we don't accept that you can put a quota on us like this." And Iceland said, "We can do, and we will do." And they went to the Americans, who had the air base at Keflavik, near Reykjavik, and they said, "Look, if you don't get these English out of our waters now, we're going to throw you out of Iceland. End of story. America rules." Well, America coughs and we catch colds, as you know, things like that. And that's how it all came about. The influence was the Cold War.
This is what I don't understand. If Iceland were prepared to give us a quota that would have met our needs, where was the political advantage for Britain in that? And where was the advantage for the Americans in us refusing that deal?
The Americans obviously just wanted to rattle the swords at Russia, because that was what was going on in the Cold, East versus West. And Iceland is strategically important. But also the Icelandics didn't like, because they were a little country being used as a political football, I believe, and they were then saying, "Look, we have got these resources, massive resources of fish. Surely we're worthy of a bit more than what you lot are all throwing at us." So they took the bull by the horns and did what they did, which I believe to this day was the right thing to do. Well, the proof is in the pudding anyway.
But so, it just seems strange that we seem to gain nothing from that in refusing those quotas. We lost everything.
We didn't lose everything, but we lost a lot, an awful lot, because of the stupidity of politicians, as usual. Fishermen were, if we was offered a quota and all that, we would use that quota and use it to our best abilities and things. We could also make it up with other places, like, you know, with Newfoundland, for example, Greenland, Norway coast, up to the Russian coast. There's all these waters, different waters we could fish. But no, they insisted it had to be Icelandic, which again is a political football.
And now, looking back, Martin, any strong feelings either way? Any change of attitude?
I think what happened had to happen, and it was showcases that really your assets should belong to you, and whatever you want to do with them, be it as a country, a very small country, you should be allowed to do that. Mm-hmm. And if you want to sell them off bit by bit in little things, but still protect them, why not? They sustain their fish, and the biggest suppliers of fish to England. So there's been a backdoor deal done on that in the first place. Because otherwise England could have said, we don't want your fish then. We can't catch it, we don't want it. But it was not that way. It was already a done deal that Icelandic fish would become, in fact, during the Cod Wars, there was still Icelandic fish being landed here. So,
Did it have an impact on relations on the dock, for instance? I mean, do I remember tension over Icelandic trawlers landing in Grimsby?
Well, yeah. Yeah, there was always the friction, and you'd always get one or two idiots want to fight with them and things like that, when they were just normal people going about their business. Whatever was going on was way above their heads. All they were, the same as what we were, with just fishermen going out there to earn a living in the worst conditions ever. So me personally, but I do know of people that hated them, blamed them for everything that had gone on, when if they had seen the bigger picture and looked in it, it was never the Icelandic people that were to blame for it. It was the high ups of different countries. So, you know.